He doesn't like the children rushing around and stabbing their feet. Something might happen. They might go too far, you see. So, to you. So then, if we think, oh, but I, excuse me. Pardon me for having the disgusting effrontery to exist. But you see, this is fake. It's as fake as it can be. It's phony. It's another kind of pride. How good I am at being humble. Huh? And it's terribly dishonest. But it is something that our cultural attitudes take very seriously. And the trouble is that having taken this seriously, and having felt for so long, through literature, through schooling, through attitudes of teachers and preachers and parents, that it's good for us to be humble, when we revolt against it, we go make the opposite mistake, you see, of being unnecessarily cocky. Because that's compensation. There is no need, you see, to take on the universe and say, I'm man, I'm the works, I'm the Lord in disguise, and all this can get lost. You don't need to do that. If you really know, you see, as I said at the end of this morning's talk, to believe that you are the disguised Lord is unnecessary. It's a form of doubt. So in the same way, to assert it in a kind of defiant way is also a form of doubt. Although, please remember, you're perfectly free to do that. Don't get caught in it by feeling that you oughtn't to. You know, I remember when I was a child, we used to read that the sin against the Holy Ghost was unforgivable. I always wonder what the sin against the Holy Ghost was. And there'd be a little thing at the back of your mind whispering, damn the Holy Ghost. To hell with the Holy Ghost, you know? Just, you know, you're absolutely sucked into it by the very prohibition, the kind of vertigo where a person looks over a precipice, feels he's got to throw himself down. That's a funny thing in human psychology. So, in many forms of symbolism that you find in the Orient, there is the idea of the liberated man who knows who he is, as the man who can't be fazed. You know, for example, that Bodhidharma, who's supposed to have brought Zen to China, is made into a toy in Japan, which is like a shmoo, only it's this shape. And it's weighted so that you can't knock it over. You push it down, but it always springs up. This is the sort of figure of this. It says a poem, seven times down and eight times up, such is life. Or it may be the image in Hindu literature of the tightrope walker, the man walking the path of the razor's edge. It's the balance again, you see. But the Bodhidharma is in a way more flexible. He can be pushed right to the floor, but the minute you let go, he's back up. Or the Taoist image of water. You can squeeze it, you can jump on it, you can cut it, but you can't hurt it. It always comes together again. Look, for example, I gave the illustration this morning of a human being as something like a whirlpool in water. Constantly changing, but always the same. Now, what happens if you chop up a whirlpool? You know, you can smash it, you can put your fist through it, and you can make it disappear for a while. But after a while, there's the pattern again. See? So in the same way, we think we can solve problems with violence. We think that killing people is an answer to a problem. It's only temporary. As if you knock out, say, a Hitler, another one comes up, because you haven't understood the problem of this sort of manifestation. Anything that's destroyed with violence eventually recurs again. Because the persistence of life in its continuity is a persistence of patterns. So long as the, for example, the principles of surface tension hold true, or the principles of crystallization, you're going to get crystals everywhere. Anywhere in the universe, you're liable to get a crystal of something or other. Well, life is the same kind of thing. It's a pattern which is going to keep cropping up. It doesn't matter how long it has to wait. A million years is nothing. You blot it out here, it'll turn up somewhere else. It's only a matter of time, because it's in the nature of the patterns. So in this sense, then, let's review these two ideas. It's, first of all, seriously speaking, sincerely speaking, I should say, is it demoralizing to believe that it's all play? That at the last minute, no, when the screaming memes are right on and everything is awful, at the very last minute, will you wake up and find it's a dream? You could say, I hope so. I hope so. But life sometimes gets so black that it's impossible to hope so. You know it's the end. Now, I remember once a marvelous conversation with Count von Durkheim, who is a kind of German Zen master. And he said, you know, during the war, people had the most utterly soul-searing experiences. He said the three general kinds of experience, of course, in the air raids, when you heard the whistling bomb right above you, and you knew that was the end. But sometimes it was a dud. And it didn't go off. But you resigned yourself as you heard that scream and completely accepted the fact that you were about to cease to exist. Or else you were in a concentration camp and you saw absolutely no hope of ever getting out alive. Absolutely none whatever, and you gave up. Or he said you were displaced. The town where you worked and you had your occupation was erased. And you were a person with absolutely no background, no career, no future, nothing. And you accepted it. Now, he said, so often in all these cases, the individual concerned had the most extraordinary experience. They had, in other words, the cosmic consciousness. Satori, they woke up, they realized suddenly that there was really nothing to worry about at all. That I, the real I, not the superficial ego, the real I, is the whole cosmos. Then he said their friends, they tried to explain this to their friends afterwards. And their friends said, oh, you're crazy. You were under such strain that you got a little touched. And so they would try to forget it and put down this experience. He said, most of my work is in reviving this and telling people that this is an authentic experience. So that's what I mean, that the gamble, that it isn't really serious. If you don't, at the last moment, you see, as it were, call in the police. If you don't scream for help. I'm using that as a metaphor. To accept, well, I'm going to die. See? That's it. There's nothing to hold on to, you see? The moment you really stop holding on to anything, because you see there is nothing to hold on to, what happens? You become the ball. Now, the ball, it has nowhere to bounce, you see? You become the ball. There's nothing to hold on to. But you can only see that when you're not holding on to anything anymore, when you've given up. Resignation, or whatever it is. In other words, that urgency to succeed, to be something, to get there, to make it, to be right. When you see, you can't, and you give up, you get reborn, because that's the death. The real meaning of going to heaven after death has nothing to do with literal death. It has to do with this death. Now, the other side of the picture. What about the notion that you're it, tattvam asi? Not only that it isn't serious, but that fundamentally, right at the root of things, you are the ultimate reality. Not you, as I repeat, as this apparently separate ego. That is a kind of phantom, like the equator, a social institution. But the you, which, as I say, grows the hair and blues the, or browns the eyes, and so on. Now, the difficulty that this presents to our common sense, and it does present a difficulty to our common sense, is that we've all been brought up to feel alienated from the world. In the sense that it is something we came into, and it is something that we confront. A meeting. We face it. So we face facts, we face reality. We encounter. Martin Buber's emphasis on dialogue, on I-thou, the confrontation. See? This is a silly notion. At least, it's silly if it doesn't have something undergirding it. You can't have a dialogue between two people who don't speak the same language. In other words, you can't have a relationship without an underlying unity. You can't have a battle, even, between the tiger and the shark, because they have no common ground. And Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle. So underlying all conflict in nature is common ground, unity. Because even when we say that two things are the poles apart, that's a way of saying they're connected. Because the whole earth joins the two poles. The whole magnet joins the north and the south poles. So, just as we have been taught to ignore the background behind the figure, the space behind the solid, so also we've been taught to ignore the joining link between the two poles. I once said that the way most of us think, somebody asks for a banana, he ought to be satisfied with just the two ends of the banana. See? When you can go so fast from San Francisco to New York that the intervening United States is abolished, San Francisco and New York become the same place. And so there's no point going to New York. But just if there's a distance between them, so some difficulty in getting from one place to the other, that not everybody in New York can go to San Francisco, not everybody in San Francisco can go to New York, then they're different places, and it's worth going there. So also, for the two ends of the banana to have any significance, you've got to have the banana of which the two ends are ends. So in the same way, each individual isn't something that comes into the world from nowhere and confronts it, or from somewhere else altogether. And the universe is not a kind of heap of flotsam and jetsam that happened to collect in space like a bunch of old rubber tires and broken logs in some little nook on the San Francisco Bay. Of course, there was the bay underneath the whole thing, you see, actually. So in the same way, to think... See, the Christians have, and the Jews, to some extent, have got over this idea that we are created out of nothing. Now, of course, there's an esoteric sense to that. In a way, a maya, an illusion, is a creation out of nothing. But suddenly the magician makes a phantasm to appear in the empty room. In a way, that's a creation out of nothing, see? He does it, say, by hypnosis, magic. But this idea of being created out of nothing has certain psychological and moral overtones or undertones in which you are supposed to be nothing down to the marrow and core of your existence. See, what that means is, psychologically, that there's someone wagging his finger at you and saying, never forget that you are really a jerk, you see? That you're a little worm. You don't deserve anything. You exist entirely by the grace and pleasure of another. And the sooner you grovel suitably to acknowledge this, the better. Because the consequences of saying this and the meaning of saying this is what's going to be done about it. But so there's the choice, you see, in your thinking, in your myth-making, in your imagination. Do you want to settle for a completely schizoid universe in which there is a gulf between the Lord and the illusion, the Brahma and the Maya, so total that forever and ever the one is not the other? Or would you rather have a unified, integrated universe in which the Maya is something that the Lord is doing? It's his act, his play, or its act, if you don't like the masculine personal pronoun. Her act, the Great Mother. And it seems to me that these two views are sort of like this, you see. We could diagram them. See, one person is looking at the universe this way. Here's the domain of existence, being. And everything comes into it thus, from nowhere. See? That's one way of looking at things. How this ever got together, you can't even think. You have to turn your mind inside out and get this kind of collected flotsam and jetsam idea. The other diagram is this. Here again is the domain of being. But it's like a star. It radiates.
The whole of it radiates each individual point of focus. You see? Now there you've got an integrated situation. And that's what things look like. Stars look like that. Crystals look like that. Octopuses look like that. Spiders look like that. Human beings stick out like that. It all works that way. Because underneath the differences, there are the differences all the way around, is the unity. If you don't know unity, you don't know you're different. They go together.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share your comments and feedback with others.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.